What I get a lot, and I really mean this, like two or three times a week, people that I've never met coming up and saying, I got into that because of the Gadget Show.
This new film that you're actually attempting to produce.
It's called Control AI Delete. When a global AI is rolled out and then goes wrong.
I ask every guest the same question at the end of the episode.
What does it mean to live a good life? Wow.
Welcome back to The Human Podcast, where I delve into the minds of a wide range of individuals by asking about their lives, careers, and ideas. If you enjoy the show, please consider hitting the subscribe button below. Okay, so I'm joined today by Jason Bradbury, probably best known for being the longtime presenter of the popular British TV show, The Gadget Show. Jason, thanks so much for coming to speak today.
Hi, Joe. Thanks for inviting me.
So, Jason, a lot of people remember when they were younger and they watched you present The Gadget Show. You were a host of that show for a 12-year period. What was that period like? It seemed like a probably pretty fun, exciting time.
Oh, it was crazy, man. It was absolutely bananas. I went from just, you know, obscurity to just being in front of, well, millions of people on the television show. And then actually, you know, like 100,000 people at the NEC. And we used to do a live version of The Gadget Show called Gadget Show Live. And it was at the NEC. And we had all the kind of exhibitors that you'd expect at a big tech expo. But then we had this thing called the Super Theater in the middle. And it had 6,000 seats in it. And we would do a live show three times a day. So that was like 18,000 people a day live. It was like being in a rock band. It was literally like being, you know, on stage at Wembley or something. And so, yeah, it was a crazy, crazy experience, flying all over the world, doing crazy things that you couldn't even do kind of if you're a millionaire, because sometimes we'd get access to, like, you know, like the military, like we'd get in the back of a military transport and we'd chuck gadgets out to see if they break because maybe the manufacturer had said on the box that they were indestructible or whatever, or we'd blow things up with dynamite. You know, or we'd put jet engines on a skateboard. I suppose you could probably put jet engines on a skateboard if you were wealthy. But you get what I mean? Like, it gave me access to incredible experiences, amazing people, meeting amazing people like you and on the street and, you know, getting really enthusiastic responses from people about the stuff that we'd done. The one thing that people would always talk about is the Gadget Show competition. That's the one thing people still, you know, say if I'm in line at the coffee shop or whatever, they'll go, God, that competition was mad. So yeah, it was a crazy experience.
That's awesome. Yeah, I was actually speaking to my housemate about this, and the first thing he brought up was that amazing competition you have to have on each show. I remember I used to watch that and be pretty excited. Fortunately, never won, but it was fun to just see all the gadgets appear one by one.
Now it's kind of pretty normal. Like, you know, there are other shows that do it, but then no one had done that before. It was definitely an original idea. In fact, the production company that made The Gadget Show, I believe, actually sold that idea on to other TV shows. It was that successful as a kind of revenue generating stream.
What were some of the most amazing gadgets or technologies you ever came across and explored on the show? Any kind of memories of things that really kind of stood out and shocked you and wowed you?
Well, it was the sort of beginnings of the resurgence of VR. So VR had been a concept that I was excited about in the 80s. I remember using the Virtual Boy from Nintendo and other. I can't remember, there was one at the Trocadero in Leicester Square. And it was like a kind of industrial, kind of arcade grade VR experience. I can't remember the name of it, Virtuality, I think it was called. And this was something that grew in the 80s and 90s. But the promise of VR had never really been realized until the first generation Oculus, you know. And I got the first gen Oculus and we reviewed various forms of it on, you know, in early series of The Gadget Show. That was a groundbreaking technology, something that now, I mean, I can show you, I've got multiple headsets here, look. Got loads of different headsets. I've had them all over the years. That was a technology that I experienced first in terms of the consumerization of virtual reality. and mixed reality throughout the gadget show. You know, we played with, I remember when I first tried HTC Vive, and there was a painting program where you could paint in the air. And it absolutely blew my mind. And I first experienced that on stage at the NEC in the aforementioned Super Theater. And because obviously I was doing so many different things, I was so busy, sometimes I'd get briefed on a piece of technology and almost minutes later I'd be talking about it on camera. And that was one such instance, except I was being briefed by the representative from HTC on this Vive headset that I was then going to do a big demonstration of in the live theater, right? So this would have been in the rehearsal, so a few days before we went live on stage. And I remember taking my credit card out and saying to the guy, because I'd known about its, you know, the fact that it was taking pre-orders, and I just said, you've got to get me on the first batch. I've got to have this. And I don't know whether I was allowed to jump the queue or not. But I remember getting the Vive at home after Gadget Show Live, and my God, that was a revelation. It was incredible. It was so much better than the Oculus. I've probably had every generation of Oculus, which now, of course, is Quest 3. And we're now living in the world of Apple Vision Pro. So yeah, that technology, we can talk more about that if you want later, but that technology was one of them. And the other technology was things like the electrification of personal vehicles, right? So we went through hoverboards, you know, as in the those sort of you know, rubbish platforms that you stood front onto that everyone used to fall over and break their coccyx. From that up to kind of electric skateboards, and now, is it in here somewhere? Maybe. We arrive at the one wheel. Excuse me. We arrive at the one wheel, which is for me the most brilliant realization of the kind of Marty McFly like experience. The one wheel with a central wheel. It's like a skateboard. You bomb around. I've had multiple versions of that. My latest one is the Pint X, which is their small one, because I can carry it through London and stuff quite easily. And that's incredible. I ride that virtually every day, you know.
So, I mean, yes, thinking about technology today, imagine there was one of these giveaways now. What are a few items you think would be featured there?
That is a really good question. No one's ever asked me that before. Every day, like I suggested earlier, complete strangers stop me on the street and they'll go, they normally say, is it you? That's a question they ask, which I think is quite a funny philosophical question. I'm like, I don't know. Is it, what is I? I normally go, yeah. And hoping that they're not going to go, are you that bloke off the One Show? Or are you that bloke from Crystal Maze? So I'd definitely put an electric bike in there. There's a brand called Cinch that I love. I've actually got one of their bikes, and that is a UK brand, really good. They're great. I'd whack a Cinch bike in there. I'd put a one wheel in there. Maybe I'd put a Steam Deck. I'd put a Steam Deck in there. I know there are lots of contenders for the Steam Deck crown, especially now, because Valve kind of carved out a new market, and then the likes of Asus or Asus, however you're supposed to say it, Lenovo, they've all got into that market. But I think the Steam Deck still wears the crown. I would definitely put a VR helmet in there. Maybe a Vision Pro, that would be the headline in there. A Vision Pro, that would be good, wouldn't it? And what else? That's a really, really good question. Maybe I'd chuck in some of the, this isn't one of them, this is an actual OG ZX Spectrum, but I'd whack in some of the kind of reimagined retro consoles. Yeah, there's a real market for miniaturized consoles, and you get a load of games with them. I'd chuck in a few that I'd have a retro representation in there. What do you think? Anything? Are you excited by that?
Yeah, no, that's an exciting list. You know, I wanted to ask you about one thing though, because I feel like maybe something you'd want to put in the basket as like being one of the most exciting things you could use is some of these kind of like AI models online. But the interesting thing, I guess, is like, whilst these are some of the most exciting things, these are often free.
I think because it's a distributed sort of cloud model, that it's difficult to productize that. And the people that have tried to do that, like the AI pin, and there's that rabbit one, isn't there? Isn't it Teenage Engineering? You'll have to fact check me. It's very difficult to go from subject to subject on the fly when everyone at home or wherever people are listening to this or watching it can just Google straight away. So correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure I just named two hardware AI products. And certainly the AI pin, as to all extents and purposes, is that even a phrase? I think it's failed, because I think AI for a consumer level is still a bit clunky. Like I'm a fully paid up OpenAI supporter, meaning I get access to GPT-4o, the Omni version, and even then, it still doesn't work very reliably. It takes ages to kind of buffer and respond. And I think there are issues with that. I think the bandwidth and the cloud storage issues around AI make it actually quite expensive. And I think so you need to invest quite a lot of money into a consumer grade product. There will be, and there are actually, there's lots of startup products out there. I'm struggling to name any. Do you know any? I mean, there's things like little robots that respond to you and things like that. I think that's definitely going to be where it goes, because things, the likes of Nvidia and so on, they've been shouting about AI on chip, and I think Apple have as well. Because obviously the aforementioned cloud issue is problematic, because it relies on your connection to the cloud. So if you're walking around with something, where I live in Cornwall, that's a problem. AI on chip means you can localize some of those, some of that machine learning. In fact, it's Microsoft, isn't it? Microsoft are doing it on chips on all their new hardware. So I think so there you go. There is an implementation of a localized AI product. It's the new range of laptops, and I'm guessing Surface is going to be a contender for that from Microsoft, unless I'm wrong.
Another thing came to mind, actually, because I saw it, I've seen it more and more in the news lately. Would you throw Starlink into there, like a subscription to one of these kind of portable Starlink devices, so you can use it off the beaten track in somewhere?
Yeah, Starlink's really interesting, isn't it? The issue with Starlink for me is it's just too expensive. So I was really interested in it. I'll be honest with you, I've got fiber here. It's insane how quick my broadband is. I live in the most remote place I've ever lived, and yet I have the quickest broadband. It's bizarre. I don't live in a remote place as such, in that I live in Cornwall, but I live in Newquay, right? But we're cut off from the rest of the UK. And yet, having lived in London and up north somewhere, this is the best broadband I've ever had. But I would have got Starlink just to play with it, just to experiment with it. I've also got a camper van, so that'd be quite cool, wouldn't it? Aside from the cost of it, though, I think it's a great technology. I think that would be a good one to pop into the fictional, what are we calling this? Kind of like Gadget Show Competition 2.0. Yeah, I'd whack Starlink in. I think that's a good suggestion.
Obviously, I think the reason you were so known, it's not just because you're a presenter, but very engaging, enthusiastic, excited presenter. Is this something that you've worked on a lot, or has this kind of always been what you've been like, part of your personality?
Yeah, obviously it's part of my personality. I mean, I'm guessing I was probably like this as a kid. I just get excited about stuff. And that translates well in certain contexts. In other contexts, like if you're married to me, it's got to be really annoying, isn't it? So my background really was two-sided. So my dad was a product, it was like a plastics expert. So he used to get prototypes from the likes of Sir Clive Sinclair, strangely enough, and Sinclair Research at the time in the late 70s, early 80s. And he'd bring home these kind of prototypes for new computers and things like that. So I got into all of that, and he was quite technical. So I had a good education in the beginnings of it wasn't the beginnings of the consumer technology age, because that would have been the 50s, but the 80s was the golden era of consumer electronics. But I was also on the other side. I was into performing. I wanted to be a comedian. I used to write things. So I ended up doing a theatre and film degree at Bristol University, where I befriended a young David Williams, as he was known then. Other people know him now as David Walliams. And we were in a double act. And Simon Pegg was in a comedy club that we used to run. We ran that with Simon Pegg and some other people. And so I had quite a good group of people around me who I didn't know then were going to go on to be really, really famous and successful. And that gave me my kind of performer's mettle. And then I kind of bummed around looking for jobs on TV. I mean, I did some good gigs. I was on a show that used to be quite famous called The Big Breakfast. That was really popular. I did some bit parts on that, and I did some science content and some stuff about the internet. I did a show called The Web Review Show for ITV, but nothing that anyone really would remember until The Gadget Show came along. And it was an audition. I did an audition and I passed the audition and I got the job. And that combination, to get back to your question of getting really excited about things, because I had this love from my dad from back in the day of novel consumer electronics. And gaming, of course. The other string to my bow was I was a first gen gamer. I mean, my first console was an Atari 2600 in 1980, and I had every console and gaming computer from that point on. And so I became the gaming aficionado. So on The Gadget Show, I made stuff. So I invented stuff and made it. And I also did gaming. Those are my two kind of key areas, with a bit of enthusiasm sauce, to make it all mix together.
After such a long period of presenting the show and exploring different technologies and gadgets, and obviously you were a fan before and a fan during, I'm just intrigued how your views of technology perhaps changed at all. Did you ever become a bit more skeptical of the value of purchasing or using technology in certain areas, or are you kind of just as enthusiastic about it all as you started before?
Well, if what you're sort of getting at is, has there been a sea change in our relationship with technology recently, then I would say I agree that we've in some ways fallen out of love with tech. But back then, during The Gadget Show, that was not the case. That was the heyday of the kind of noughties obsession with, the internet. The internet was really young when we started The Gadget Show. Like I said, Wi-Fi wasn't a thing, meaning it wasn't rolled out to the general public in a meaningful way in the first series of The Gadget Show. I remember doing some kind of Wi-Fi kind of what is Wi-Fi and how does it work and all that sort of stuff. 3G, GPRS was probably, the precursor to 3G. That's Global Packet Reporting System, if you're interested, which was a type of mobile data connectivity, was the fastest kind of connection you could get on a phone. Smartphones were just beginning. The iPhone hadn't been launched in the first series of The Gadget Show. I'm pretty sure that's true. If it was, then it was in the first series, but it wasn't launched pre-Gadget Show. So there was lots to be excited about. Do you get what I mean? We hadn't sold our data down the river like all of us have. We hadn't been weren't going to websites and getting nothing but ridiculous adverts that make it impossible to read whatever story you're looking at. Big tech hadn't ganged up against us. Or is that a bit political for your podcast?
No, say anything you want.
Well, it was a less cynical age. We weren't signed up to loads of stuff that you now forget about, and then you wonder why you've got no money at the end of the month, because you're kind of paying little monthly subscriptions to stuff that you never even wanted in the first place. I mean, big tech have become very wise to manipulating us as a kind of source of revenue. That wasn't the case on The Gadget Show. It was still a relatively analog model where you went into a shop and you bought something. So there was less to be cynical about. Social media really hadn't even started in a meaningful sense. I remember Instagram was a thing, but not like it is now. There was no such thing as influencers. There was no YouTube, and TikTok didn't exist. So that kind of oversaturation of our lives, and certainly the oversaturation of young people, like my kids, with constant content, and what that does to a growing mind, which makes us all feel a bit cynical of technology now, which is what I think you were referencing, that hadn't happened either. So we were a bit loved up. We were still in love with tech when we did The Gadget Show.
I definitely owe a big part of my interest in technology to The Gadget Show, not only because it was great, but also because I feel like I didn't really remember anything else being that devoted to it. It felt like the main thing that I could see on TV to help me kind of understand it. Have you had a lot of people over the years telling you a similar thing? Like, do you think it was an important show to kind of really help the public understand technology?
Yeah, because now people that watched it as kids are adults in the workplace. What I get a lot, and I really mean this, like two or three times a week, is people that I've never met coming up and saying, I'm a programmer, or I work in IT, or you know, I'm a science teacher, and I'm doing it partly. I mean, this sounds so, I don't know, this sounds vain. It's just a statement of fact. Like, this happens to me, rightly or wrongly. They say to me, I got into that because of the gadget show. And so that's a huge compliment, isn't it? If that show was able to inspire people, then it's brilliant. But of course, it wasn't just me. I was one of the hosts, but there was an amazing team of people that were really good at editorial. A lot of ex Top Gear people, as it happens, who'd sort of started their careers on Top Gear, then moved across to the production company that at the time were making an alternative to Top Gear called Fifth Gear. And that's the company that made the gadget show. So, I was getting handed all these amazing ideas from these brilliant people. In fact, being on the show was something of an education in terms of how to editorialize tech. So it's those people really that deserve the credit.
Yeah, so obviously it was very exciting looking at all these products. And as we've just discussed, like, it's obviously it was motivating for you because you were helping educate people in technology. But was there any aspect of your life whilst you were filming that show that was the most difficult? What was most challenging about kind of leading, presenting on the gadget show?
The travel was a killer, because we went all over the world, and that was grueling, like physically and practically, because I had young children that I didn't get to see that much, and I was on the show for 12 years, so it was a big chunk of their lives growing up, and that was hard. And that was partly the reason why eventually I left, made the decision to leave. And I think that's it, really. I mean, also, becoming famous is quite a weird one. It's cool. It's really exciting and fun. But it's also a bit, you make yourself a bit of a target for people. People feel, I don't know, I think maybe because some celebs mouth off a bit. And I'm definitely guilty of having done that at times. Like, giving your political opinion, things like that, it's probably not the best idea. I think I did that 10 minutes ago. And then quite rightly, people have an opinion on that. But people seem to be a bit harsh to celebs. But then a lot of you get a lot in that deal. You know, it's life-changing. Obviously, it's a well-paid job. You get to do incredible stuff. So fair enough. But it doesn't mean that I didn't find it difficult, because I did. That's just a truthful answer, you know. But then I feel like I kind of get the best of it, really. What I mean is people are generally really nice to me. 99% of the time, they're really sweet and enthusiastic, and it's an amazing thing, and I feel hugely privileged. But once in a while, someone will say something mean, you know, on social media. Maybe it's me, but maybe I'm too sensitive, but it always hurts your feelings. But that's just part of the deal, isn't it?
Yeah, unfortunately, it seems to be. How do you think that show like changed you as a person?
Wow, these are really deep questions, man. I don't know. Like, I suppose if it did change my lifestyle, because I mean, obviously, I made quite a lot of money doing it. That I definitely didn't have beforehand. I mean, I was skint when I did the audition for the gadget show, and it enabled me to buy a house and to do cool things, like, again, that you'd never normally get access to. So there's a whole kind of PR marketing world that you get invited into when you're on the television and when you've got kids. So we'd do things like, we'd get invited to the opening of Harry Potter World, or we'd get invited to a red carpet event in Leicester Square to go and see a new movie. And those invitations generally come with, you know, you get like a party bag, and you get some, like, the poster for the movie, and some, you know, some like toys for the kids. And you know, do you know what I mean? Like, it's amazing. I mean, I don't think I've ever paid to go to Disneyland. I got invited there about 3 or 4 times. Actually, it's not true. We did pay to go to Disneyland last summer, actually, for my daughter. But when I was on the show, you get invited to these amazing things. And then cool things like abroad, like you'll get invited by a brand that wants to showcase their new technology. And so it's a kind of all expenses paid trip to South Korea. These are things I could never afford to do. I could never have afforded to do before the gadget show. And they're the things that I was privileged enough to experience, you know, during that amazing period.
And you guys have kind of come back in a sense now in one respect, which is you've now started the Gadget Show podcast.
Yeah, that's great. So I've not done anything, I guess, for about 7 years since I left the Gadget Show. And I left the Gadget Show just because I'd kind of done everything I wanted to do, and I wanted to spend time with the kids. And it was you know, amicable and quite straightforward. But nevertheless, I didn't really want to go back. And I didn't want to go back to television, because television can be quite a cynical place. I wanted to just be part of the kind of new kind of citizen journalism, the idea of doing my own kind of content. They call it content creator, don't they? That's the kind of standard phrase. And I wanted that freedom. When I got the call, it was sufficiently far enough away from leaving for me to go, do you know what? I wouldn't mind that. And the fact that Susie's in the seat next to me was a winner. And yeah, so we've done one series of the Gadget Show podcast, and I would invite everyone to listen to it on, YouTube or Spotify or whatever. And we're coming back. I don't know when we're coming back, but we're coming back. We've been commissioned to do another series, so I'm really excited about that. And it's very much like the early days of the Gadget Show. Susie and I have this kind of vibe. We just get each other in a room and we instantly start giggling, and that's nice. And we can't do the big tests that we used to do on the show, like going out in the mountains and jumping off, you know, suspension bridges on bungee cords and things like that. But I flew a new drone in the studio, which is quite a big kind of warehousey studio. We've tested VR loads of times. We talk a lot about AI. We've done loads of cool physical tech. We do something physical with a gadget on the table or in the room every time we do the show. So yeah, tune in. It's fun.
Sounds good. So it'd be good now to move on a bit and talk about what you're actually up to these days. So starting with focusing on this new film that you're actually attempting to produce, which is exciting. So this is called Control AI Delete. Can you tell us all about this, Jason?
Yeah, so this is the sort of project that I actually left the Gadget Show originally to pursue. I mean, I'd always written films. I know it sounds like a weird thing, but I've got a writing partner that I've worked with over the years, a stand-up comedian called Mark Felgate, who's better known for being part of a kind of physical comedy double act called Men in Coats. And they've been on things like, I think they got to the semi-final of Italy's Got Talent or something like that. And yeah, so Mark and I have always written stuff together. In fact, Mark, actually, we invited Mark onto the Gadget Show and he wrote jokes for Robo Jace. That was one of our most ambitious builds, where we made a robot version of myself. And the joke was, can we get rid of Jason and replace him with a robot? The answer, luckily, was no, because it was terrible. Like the chatbot software that we used was awful. And I can tell you why we know that, because we put Robo Jace in a comedy club and Mark, my comedy writer partner, was used to write jokes for him, you know, about, you know, my floppy disk and stuff like that. And it was hilariously bad. But but Mark and I have always been writing partners. We've written a couple of film or TV ideas before. And then we just came up with this idea around the kind of fascination with AI that has gripped everyone in the last 2 years. And that's really what the film was about. It's a full feature film and it's called Control AI Delete. It's about a bunch of retro gamers at an expo in Skegness who happen to be there when a global AI is rolled out and then goes wrong. So we're not talking Terminator, you know, and robots with laser guns and stuff. Literally all that happens is the AI is rolled out. It controls everything and it just goes wrong and nothing works. So planes fall out of the sky, there's a run on the banks, the stock market crashes, there are protesters that become rioters on the streets, pandemonium, looting, absolute traffic chaos, right? But our little band of retro gamers, safely ensconced in the expo center, realize that with their 80s and 90s computers, they might have the only solution available to hack the AI and win the day. And that's the idea. And we're going to Kickstarter. We're hoping that the eventual viewers of the film are going to fund it. So it's my first. I've backed loads of projects on Kickstarter, but I've never done my own Kickstarter. And that's what we're doing. And it starts on September the 27th. So please go over. We've got some great, go over there and check it out. We've got some great merch. I'm actually wearing some of the merch. Would you like to see it? The logo on the back. You see that? There's the merch logo. There's we've got caps. We've got all kinds of cool. This isn't meant to be an advert, by the way. I'm meant to be inspiring people. You can actually, one of the things you can do, because you know how it works, Joe. You're like, what you do is you put rewards together, packages together, right? So items like, you know, hoodies or a clapperboard as used on set, signed by the cast and crew, things like that, or props from the movie. And then you hopefully people invest in those rewards. So they get the reward, but they also, the profit from that is what funds the movie, right? So we've tried to be really creative. So some of the cool stuff that we've come up with for the Kickstarter is, one of the coolest things is you can be in the film. All right, I'm looking at you, Joe. You can be an extra in the movie in the riot scenes. It's called Riot Star. All right. And then there's another tier higher up, which is called Riot Leader. And that means that you're a featured extra, right? Which means you get a bigger credit. You get your name in the credits for both of these, but you're on the front lines, right? With your bandana over your face and you're like, with your riot sign. So we try to be really creative in terms of how people can, you know, help us to fund the movie. Another one, I hope this isn't turning into a TV advert.
No, please keep going.
I think you'll find this interesting because we're trying to think creatively about how to enable people to back the project, right? I think the coolest reward, right, what do we call it? I can't remember what we called it. Anyway, it gives you the opportunity to be one of the high score. It's called High Score Hero. And you can be one of the high scores on the fictional arcade game that's at the center of the movie. So the fictional arcade game is called Stardash. It's what our lead character plays, and it plays a critical role in the movie. But anyway, it gets featured several times, but obviously we're going to make sure that it flicks to the high score screen, you know, like they do in arcades. And your name next to a score, we're selling those. You can buy your name. I just think that's such a cool reward. So there you go. Yeah, that's the Kickstarter. Control, if you want to, can I give you the URL?
Absolutely. We'll put it in the description as well, but please say it now as well.
Thanks, Joe. Thank you. It's controlaidelete.net. That's the website. And if you go there, it'll link you to the Kickstarter. So control is spelled CTRL, like on the keyboard. CTRL, AIdelete.net.
Okay. Well, sounds very exciting. I've got a couple questions about it. I mean, firstly, how long are you hoping to make this? The length of the film, how long is it going to be?
Full feature film. So whatever that ends up being, you know, anything more than an hour and a half, I'm guessing. And the idea is that assuming, touch wood, that we're fortunate enough to get it funded with your help, then we'll go into pre-production straight away and we'll start pulling locations together, which we've already scouted. We're going to film it in Lincolnshire if all things go as planned. We've got an actual Hollywood director, a lady named Elizabeth Blake Thomas, who's an old friend of mine who left London, where she was my neighbor with her daughter, went off to LA and became a film director. And she's directed more than 10 feature films and small independent budget movies. So she's ideal for us because this is obviously going to be a very small budget endeavor compared to the kind of standard film budgets. But it's great because she's a proper LA, you know, schooled director. We'll start pre-producing and we hope to start filming in the spring of 2025 with a kind of, let's just say, I don't know, autumn 2025 final version. So people should be getting the film if they've gone for the digital download option or the Blu-ray, which we're offering. A signed Blu-ray, which is very, very cool, isn't it? Making your own Blu-ray. How cool is that going to be? So that's the timeline for it.
I'm intrigued. Yeah. What inspired you to create this film? When did you come up with the idea? Why do you want to do it? Things like this.
Well, I can be honest with you, actually, if you really want the true story, Mark was really ill in hospital about 2 years ago, and he had a really bad condition that affected his lungs. And it was kind of, I believe it was at one point, it was quite touch and go. And so I was ringing him in the hospital a couple of times a week. And I said, when you get out of hospital, we're going to write the movie that we're going to make. We're going to actually make it. Because when we used to write stuff before, we had to go to production companies and pitch the ideas, right? That's how it used to work. Now, because of brilliant things like Kickstarter, Indiegogo, you know, Crowdfunder, you can actually go to the source. You can go straight to the viewers, the customers, and ask them to fund the movie in advance, right? And that's a really sort of democratic way of making, you know, your gadget idea or your, you know, your comic book, or in this case, your movie. And so he pulled through, and then we kept to the plan. We met over a period of about a year on, it would have been Zoom, I think, and we wrote the movie over Zoom. And the rest of it, I think I've brought you up to speed on how the rest of it kind of flowed from there. But it was based on the fact that he wasn't well, and it was a bit scary. I thought, my God, this is my mate. And we've got to act now, because we've all got to act now, haven't we? You've got to do your stuff. You know, I'd say that to anyone. Whatever gets you going, you know, if you've got ambition, if you've got an idea, you really need to get on with it. Because at the tender age of 55, I can tell you, life moves so much more quickly than you expect it to. And that's another reason why I'm doing it now. Because, I mean, some people retire at 65, don't they? Some people retire at 55. But what have I got? 10 years to really motor. So I'm doing it, and I want to do this one, and then I want to do another one after it.
Nice. Yeah, I was going to ask, it could just be the start of a few films, but if this all goes good, you'd go for another.
Yeah. Most certainly. We already thought about storylines, and we've written it with a view to that happening. I like the idea of doing a kind of low British, gritty British comedy version of some of the classic sci-fi tropes or genre ideas, you know, like a robot film, or, you know, in this case, an AI movie. I think it's quite funny. It's not without precedent. I mean, you know, it's what Simon Pegg did. He took the, he took the zombie genre, didn't he? And he kind of just made it in a very British way, in a very grassroots, raw British way, which was just inherently funnier than throwing a Hollywood kind of the classic Hollywood narrative approach at it. Fingers crossed.
Would you say it's more kind of just pure for the fun, for entertainment, or at the same time are you trying to convey a bit of a message to people about the future of robotics and AI?
Definitely. We're not being preachy, but yeah, we're definitely grabbing the kind of zeitgeist. The AI zeitgeist. What is AI? What the hell are we doing? Oh my God. Is anyone in control of this? Why does this gadget not work? Why does my Windows computer keep, you know, crashing? I've not got anything against Microsoft, by the way. I'm just trying to think of the stuff that happens. Like why does nothing really work that well? Or why am I getting such a bad experience from this technology? What if the power gets turned off? We're at a kind of interesting point in our technological evolution. Technology is now so endemic to everything we do. It's so completely, wired into every aspect of our lives. It does raise the question, what happens if someone turns the switch off, right? And that's what the film is about. And obviously what happens is a group of very unlikely heroes, geeky gamers that are on the kind of peripherals of normal society, come up with a plan. And that's why it's funny, because you don't expect it to be those people that solve a global problem. So that's that's kind of the hook, I think. Yeah. And it very much is a statement about the vulnerable position we seem to have put ourselves in.
It's great to hear about that film. I just want to now finish with like a couple final questions about yourself, Jason. So I'm intrigued. Yeah, outside of this new film you're working on, what other kind of work are you up to these days? I know you kind of do talks for organizations.
I tell you something funny. What I do, Joe, for a living is I talk about AI. and generally, the message that, and it's at sort of tech corporate events. So I'm a keynote speaker. That's what I do. And, you know, imagine like TED, if most people have seen a TED talk, it's like that, but big events for, you know, all kinds of brands, BMW, Vodafone, Microsoft, might be a group of lawyers or a marketing conference. And obviously I used to talk about all kinds of, transformative technologies, using a concept that I call the 1,000-year decade, which posits that we're going to see 1,000 years of growth in the next 10 years because of the exponential nature of everything. And I still do that. But obviously, AI has become the big headline issue that most companies want to understand, right? The lawyers want to understand how is it going to affect law, and marketeers want to understand what areas of AI should we be focusing on and what investments should we make. And I help people in a general sense to understand what AI is and where it's likely to go. So I use the past, the present, and the future to map out our technological journey, right? And I'm very enthusiastic about it. I'm really excited about AI. I love using, all the kind of natural language engines, and I think they're really fascinating. And if you work on your own or in a small team, they're a really cost-effective source, of ideas generation, right? But obviously, there are also issues. There are problems. There are some big problems down the line when we look at kind of like the kind of march towards superintelligence, like the almost instant creation of new weapons or biological agents. So that they're the big philosophical questions that we need to ask ourselves. But there are also some more, I don't know, kind of everyday concerns around jobs and around, I think it was the World Economic Forum predicted that 25% of all jobs are going to be disrupted in some way by AI in the next 5 years. Well, that's quite a scary statistic, right? And people want to understand that. But my approach, as you mentioned earlier, being the enthusiasm, the enthusiastic one on the gadget show, it is to look at what's exciting about AI and look to understand it and utilize it. Although people always, they do always come in the Q&A at the end. They always come with the big questions about explosive superintelligence.
Yeah, I'm guessing a lot of these kind of talks that you give to companies, organizations are in London or other cities like this. I'm intrigued. I'm not sure where you lived before, but what inspired you to move down to Cornwall? Is it connected to any hobbies you have? Do you surf?
So basically, it's just the yin and yang thing, isn't it? It's like I'm doing these big conferences. I was doing the telly stuff. When you're in that world, you need your downtime, don't you? Especially as you get a bit older. And also my kids were getting older and they're part of that digital native generation. So they will glue themselves to content 24/7 if you let them. So what better than to live? I mean, if I open that door, I can see the ocean. I'll have to stand up on my tiptoes, but I can. And I could walk to it with my surfboard in my hand in 5 minutes. And there's about another 4 beaches that are 10 or 15 minutes walk from my house. That's why we're here. Mountain biking, one wheeling on the beach, surfing, scuba diving, all of that stuff, man. That's what's great about living on the Southwest Peninsula.
And you've talked a bit about getting older, you know, 55. Like, how do you think the next 20 years of your life or so may change and perhaps, as you said, significantly change given what's happening in tech and AI?
Well, one of the areas I'm really interested in part based on the fact that my wife is a nutritional therapist, so she's kind of like a food scientist, really, is how health is moving forward. And that's an area that I talk about in my talks. I talk about, how we're using technology to monitor our health. And I talk about some bonkers concepts like 3D food printers, which is quite an interesting idea. The idea of printing sort of nutritionally targeted food, which sounds crazy, feels a bit Star Trek, until you realize that actually trying to get various nutrients or specific needs that a child has into them in a way that is fun and that they're going to put in their mouth and not get all, you know, upset about. Actually printing out a little starfish with a smiley face that happens to have whatever it is that you need to give the child is actually a really, really good idea. And although it's a great, I talk about this because it's problematic. So if you're listening to this thinking, what? That's the idea, is it's to stimulate conversation at the events that I do. More generally, you know, I'm interested in any tech, like the rings that are coming out that can monitor your sleep patterns, the Apple Watches and all the contenders for Apple Watches Crown. I love all that insight. The more insight, the better. I'm really health conscious. I use all kinds of cool tech to work out and to keep fit. I'm really focused on fitness, Joe, and that's because as I get older, that's become a thing for me. If I don't work out, I start to feel achy and slow. And I've got a cool gadget, actually, Joe, that you might want to look up. It's called the Vitruvian. And it's like a slab that slides under the sofa. I pull it out and it's like a resistance training thing. It's like having a gym that uses, I think it's some form of sort of electromagnetic resistance. But you effectively have barbells and overhead rack things, but it all comes from the floor. It's kind of a weird concept. So I use a lot of that. I use a lot of technology to stay fit. But my answer to your question really is that I think I will be more focused around health and fitness as I move into, you know, the next decade.
I guess then you're someone who's probably pretty interested in these even more kind of radical approaches to kind of longevity and life extension. You know, you've got people trying to kind of cure aging. Are you someone who would pop a pill to live hundreds of years if you could?
If the pill was relatively natural in origin, I'm not a big fan of pharmaceutical solutions. Obviously they're very necessary in certain situations, but touch wood, not for me at the moment. I use targeted nutrition based on blood tests, saliva, stool analysis that my wife does through labs with her clients, but often I'm the test subject for those things. So I've got an understanding of my key kind of inflammatory markers, if that means anything to anyone listening and watching. I'm aware that, you know, I've got a dairy sensitivity. Gluten's not good for me. My mom's a celiac. I've got all the lab tests that show, you know, why I've got a propensity towards asthma and sort of various, I mean, you did ask, Joe, so I'm giving you the details. You know, various sensitivities. And I eat with that in mind. I eat accordingly. And I've been able to work on my gut health because my wife's helped me do that. And that's alleviated hay fever and asthma. So I no longer need to take asthma sprays or take antihistamines because I'm managing that with good food and good physical health. I forget what the question was, but that's a more in-depth and very personal response to your question. I hope that's kind of what you were asking.
No, that's great. Okay, Jason, so final question, and another deep one for you, because I know you like those. So I ask every guest the same question at the end of the episode, which is, what do you think it means to live a good life?
Wow, man, you are deep, Joe. I never expected this.
Is that an insult? No,
it's a huge compliment. what does it mean to live a good life? Wow. Well, I think from a subjective perspective, you need to find what makes you happy and pursue it, which is not as easy as it sounds because we're constantly dogged by modern problems like paying the mortgage, you know, remaining employed, keeping your relationships together. These are tricky things. I mean, really, you know, being honest, the whole point of me is my kids. That's really the point. And I do, to a certain extent, live vicariously through them. And I love watching them grow and flourish. And they're really good people. They're really moral people. To live a good life. But then, that's not for everyone. So it can't be the only answer to that question, because some people don't want or have children. And in that sense, isn't it about empowering other people and maybe connecting with people? And maybe to bring it full circle, isn't that what's so special about having been on a show that people loved? I mean, people didn't just like the gadget show, they loved it. And I get to connect with a little bit of that love every time I meet someone in the coffee shop or whatever. So I know it's a very floppy answer, but my goodness, what a difficult question.
Well, I think you answered it great, Jason. And yeah, thanks so much for sharing everything with us today. It's been fascinating, and wishing you all the best of luck with the film. We'll put some details in it below the video. So thanks so much.
Oh, Joe, thanks, man. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks for watching this episode. If you enjoyed it, please consider hitting the subscribe button below, and I hope to see you here again.